Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. There's not one clear message yet to take from yesterday's primary elections in five states, and in some cases, the votes are still being counted. Republican Senator John McCain won in Arizona, as did big spending outsider Rick Scott in Florida's governor's race. In Alaska, incumbent Senator Lisa Murkowski trails the Tea Party favorite Joe Miller by such a slim margin that a winner probably won't be known for at least a week. Joining us from Washington is Jay Newton Small, national political correspondent for Time magazine. And Jay, let's start in Arizona. John McCain won his party's nomination there handily, but this wasn't easy for McCain. Is he out of the woods yet, or is he going to have to spend, what, another $20 million between now and November?
It was a huge amount of money, $20 million in a primary, and a lot of that was left over, actually, from his presidential campaign. But he's pretty much in the clear. You know, I spoke with somebody from Democratic senatorial committee this morning who didn't seem like they were going to spend much money in Arizona to try and defeat McCain because they feel he's pretty strong.
Speaking of his presidential campaign, let's go to the state briefly of his vice presidential candidate in that race, Sarah Palin. If we go to Alaska, incumbent Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski, she's in a nail biter there with Gulf War veteran and lawyer Joe Miller. Miller was endorsed by Sarah Palin and the Tea Party. Did people expect the race to be this tight?
Not at all. I was shocked. Everyone thought this race would be absolutely easy for Lisa Murkowski to win. The last polls, which I think the last ones were taken actually in July, showed her up by like 20 points. And so the fact that Joe Miller is actually leading her by 1,960 votes is kind of amazing, although we still have about 8,000 absentee ballots that need to be counted. So we won't know for sure who actually won for at least a week.
And in Arizona as well, Ben Quayle, 33-year-old son of former Vice President Dan Quayle, what did he accomplish in the primaries yesterday?
He actually pulled out a victory, and I really never thought he could, frankly. And that just sort of goes to show what a huge sort of war chest of money will do for you and name recognition, because his press in the last week was all the kind of press that you would never want to have. You know, it turns out that he'd been ghostwriting these very racy posts on a local porn site. He'd borrowed his brother's children to take pictures in a campaign video. So, I mean, he's got all this kind of really bad coverage. He hasn't been a very good candidate, and yet he still won. So, you know, amazing.
In Florida, let's talk about that race a little bit now. We have U.S. Representative Kendrick Meek, who won the Democratic nomination for Senate over controversial billionaire businessman Jeff Green. But tough fight ahead for Meek. He's got Republican Mark Rubio and Independent Governor Charlie Crist. What do you think that's shaping up to look like at this point? And what can we take from the primaries as we look forward?
I think certainly a lot of people in the Democratic establishment were almost hoping for a Jeff Green win, because then it would be so much easier for them to sort of tacitly endorse Crist. And a lot of people have, frankly, already pretty much endorsed Crist. A lot of Crist's campaign staff comes from former, you know, Democratic staffers in the state. And he's indicated that, you know, hinted that if he wins, he would caucus with the Democrats. So Meek being the nominee puts the Democrats in a very awkward position of, do you want to hedge your bets and go with the winner, likely winner, who is Crist, who's leading in all the polls, or do you go all balls out for Meek and say, we're going to really, you know, work for you, raise money for you, and at the risk of possibly losing Crist back to the Republicans.
So is there any kind of trend from these primaries? We've heard different things, incumbent, anti-establishment, voter anger. What can we take from this?
Well, it's all over the place, really. I mean, there's certainly a lot of voter anger out there. You can see with the loss, you know, with Murkowski's potential loss, and with the loss of Bill McCollum, who is in Florida is the governor gubernatorial candidate there, Republican gubernatorial candidate. He lost in another surprise. He was literally the establishment candidate. I mean, Haley Barbour, who's head of the Republican Governors Association, was supposed to spend the night with him there, and he ended up losing to a wealthy businessman named Rick Scott, who spent $50 million on the primary. So, there's some people who certainly in the establishment have felt the anger, voter anger, but then there are others who are very clearly in establishment, such as John McCain, such as Kendrick Meek, who are winning.
Okay, so Jay Newton Small, national political correspondent for Time magazine. Thanks very much. This weekend marks 5 years since Hurricane Katrina devastated the Gulf Coast. On August 29, 2005, Katrina made landfall. On that day, we spoke with Robert Calley, Director of Forecast Operations at the Hydrometeorological Center in Camp Springs, Maryland, just hours after it happened.
It was an enormous storm. It was very powerful. I don't know in the total ranking of all hurricanes where it'll fit, but I believe it'll be in the top 10 to 15 as far as powerful hurricanes hitting the United States.
The Pew Climate Center ended up listing Katrina as one of the top six storms, and it turned out to be the costliest hurricane ever to hit the U.S., at least $80 billion in damage. 1,500 people died in Louisiana alone. 180,000 homes were damaged or destroyed. And even today, the city is much smaller than it once was. We're going to touch down on New Orleans today with Bruce Nolan, reporter for the Times-Picayune. He joins us now from WWNO in New Orleans. Welcome.
Hello.
Also on the line with us is Bill Quigley. He's co-author of what's known as the New Orleans Pain Index. He's also legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York while on sabbatical this year from Loyola University. Welcome, Bill.
Well, thank you very much.
Bruce, I'd like to start with you. You've written a story saying that, or describing New Orleans as being physically and psychologically, quote, like a patient recovering from a whole body burn. Can you describe what the city's like right now?
Well, if you can imagine being dragged out of a house fire with a burn over 60% of your body or so, and what the next year or two or three are going to be like, months and months of hospitalization, then comes months and months of private rehab, and then finally you get back to work. But when you're back to work, you're thinner, you've lost weight, you don't have the stamina that you used to, and your friends can see scar tissue poking out from your cuffs and above your collar, and people can look at you and they can know that something really bad happened here. That's the situation in New Orleans now. I mean, there is evidence in every neighborhood that something terrible happened. There are vacant lots, there are blighted houses, there are neighborhoods that look strange now because they're rebuilt in different ways than they had been before August 29th of 2005. And there are some neighborhoods that have barely come back at all.
And what about psychologically? How do people act now that you think that you can tell is a direct result of the storm?
Well, the rhythms of life were a little bit different here in late August and early September. We're not suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome, but late August and early September is a time of the year where we change our rhythms a little bit. Our pantries are a little bit fuller of stocked canned food. We draw down our freezers and leave them as empty as we can in case we have to evacuate and are locked out of the city for 4 or 5 or 6 days and we lose the freezers, as all of us did 5 years ago. We tend not to schedule important, expensive, immovable things like weddings or vacations for the last 2 weeks of August and the first 2 weeks of September. And every family has an evacuation plan. It's a list of things that goes in the car and the things that get waterproofed and left behind. So when we enter this time of year, we're better prepared than we were 5 years ago, and we're prepared basically to hot-footed out of town on about 24 hours' notice and button up things as best we can.
Bill Quigley, you compile what's known as a pain index every year. And how have you seen this change in New Orleans over the years that you've been putting it together?
The numbers of people that have come back to New Orleans have sort of flattened out here in the last year or so. So I think perhaps the city is about 100,000 fewer people than we were 5 years ago. And I don't think that in the near future we're going to grow dramatically. There's another 50,000 or so in the surrounding area that haven't made it back. And so New Orleans is a smaller city. It is a whiter city than it was 5 years ago, and that's reflecting the fact that large numbers of African American citizens who lived in New Orleans haven't made it back. It's a little bit more affluent city, which again reflects that large number of the very poorest people haven't made it back. We have undergone some significant transformation in our public education system, that New Orleans now leads the country in terms of charter schools. Over half of our public schools are charter schools.
Is that a positive or is that a negative?
I think right now it is mixed. It's certainly a positive for some children. I think a number of the charter schools as experiments are successful experiments. I think, however, for a number of other children, it is bad because there has been further marginalization of the special needs children, children with learning disabilities and the like. And the charter schools really rarely make a mission to the children with special educational needs part of their outreach and their screening criteria and the like.
But I know, Bruce, you recently wrote, though, that the educational landscape really in New Orleans is something that's positive and to be celebrated. You cited a report that says that 59% of New Orleans public school students are in schools that meet state quality standards, compared with only 28% before the storm.
Well, that's true, but I hasten to add that that's relative. The state of the New Orleans public school system before the storm is really difficult to describe in a way that people would believe it. It was hopelessly dysfunctional, unable to consistently pay its own employees properly because it couldn't figure out the computer system that ran the paychecks. There was only one direction to go after that, and it was up. And so after the storm, people all over the political landscape recognized in many sectors that this was a chance to start over with a new piece of paper.
I also want to ask you, Bruce, about the Road Home program. You've described that as an inquisition. Can you remind us of what that program was and why you think it's been painful for so many people?
In simple terms, the Road Home promised to make whole up to $150,000 a homeowner by providing him or her a check for relief minus their insurance coverage. In practice, however, the program combined all of the customer service skill of the IRS in its bad days with the generosity of a mean credit card company. It was Kafkaesque in its ability to lose your files, to not return messages, to put a succession of clerks on the phone who had no idea who you were and what your address was. It put people who were already on their backs, literally living in trailers, raising children in formaldehyde-soaked trailers. It put those people through the agonies of the damned. It took a good 2 years to work out, and for many people was a peculiarly horrible torture coming on top of everything else, and was the subject of enormous animosity in town.
That's Bruce Nolan, reporter for the Times-Picayune. We're also speaking with Bill Quigley, co-author of The New Orleans Pain Index. When we come back, we'll have more on New Orleans recovery and how the BP oil disaster is affecting the city. We'll be back after a break, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation about how New Orleans is faring nearly 5 years since Hurricane Katrina tore through the Gulf Coast. The day after the storm made landfall, August 30th, 2005, we spoke with Corey Reese of the New York Times when there were still high expectations of the federal government.
FEMA's still responding to Katrina, but if the past is any guide, last season Florida saw 4 hurricane strikes, and FEMA got a lot of applause from local and state officials for its swift response. So hopefully they'll be able to manage that again.
Well, as we know, FEMA was not able to manage that again. Its role has been widely criticized, including its Road Home program, which was set up to help homeowners rebuild. Thousands of people still have not received any money from that program. Nearly $1 billion has yet to be paid out. Our guests are Bruce Nolan of the Times-Picayune and Bill Quigley, Loyola University law professor and co-author of what's known as the New Orleans Pain Index. And Bill, we heard what Bruce Nolan thought of the Road Home program. What about you? What do you think?
I think everything that Bruce said about the Road Home program is absolutely correct, that it was poorly planned, poorly executed, very erratic in terms of what happened. But also to start from the understanding is that that program was only assisted homeowners, and New Orleans is 50% or more renters. And the assistance for renters was dramatically less than the assistance for homeowners. And the homeowners who were most disadvantaged in that program were, again, the elderly, people who didn't have access to lawyers and didn't have access to computers. And that Loyola Law School, where I work, helped dozens of elderly and disadvantaged people recover hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars that they should have gotten years before, but because they couldn't navigate that program, they were pushed to the end of the line like so many others. Obviously, we could not be talking about New Orleans without the assistance that the government gave us and without the assistance that hundreds of thousands of individuals and churches and community organizations and the like came down and helped us rebuild our homes and our neighborhoods and our churches and our community centers and the like.
And Bruce, you actually mentioned volunteers in one of your recent stories and their role in helping to rebuild New Orleans. Are volunteers still around? Are they still helping out?
They are still around, and the story of volunteers in New Orleans is one of the most extraordinary stories of the entire storm. New Orleans has been the subject of the most sustained outpouring of domestic relief in the history of the United States. I'm talking about hundreds of thousands of individuals who came down here. I've met so many of them who took early retirement to come down and live in an RV in a church parking lot. Young men and women who came down, took a look around, and found their lives transformed and went back to Pennsylvania or Florida and told their friends in the church groups or sororities or fraternities, you've got to come see this. And I have met more than one person who has told me that they were entertaining thoughts of taking their lives. They could not go much more. When there came a knock on the trailer door, and some young person in a clipboard said, "Madam, I'm from so and so church or so and so rebuilding program, and your name has come up to the top of the list, and we're here to give you some sheetrock or a roof or tile your house, or let me see what we can do for you now." And I've met more than one person who told me that at the moment that knock came, they were absolutely at the end of their rope.
Bill, in your pain index, you also talked about the oil spill and how that has affected New Orleans. Now, obviously not a consequence of Katrina. So why put it in your index?
Well, it has an impact certainly on the Gulf Coast, but there really actually is a connection between oil spill and Katrina and the impact, at least on New Orleans and some of the other coasts. And that is that in the last 50 years, nearly a quarter of our coastal wetlands have converted to open water. Places that were land or marshes and that sort of thing, there's no more land there anymore because the marshland, the very fragile ecosystem that we had, was crisscrossed thousands and thousands of times and dredged so that our nation and our industries and that could extract oil from our coastlands. And as a result of that, the impact of storms is magnified along the coast because these wetlands used to act as a buffer and absorb some of the tidal waves, some of the wind, some of that. But now there's more of a clear track between the Gulf of Mexico and the city of New Orleans and many other places along the Gulf. Mm-hmm. And it has a direct impact on our ability to be a viable community.
Bruce, you wrote that in the months after Katrina, everyone would immediately ask each other, so how'd you make out? I'd like to ask you at the end of our conversation here, how did New Orleans make out?
New Orleans nearly died. It nearly died. Happily, tourism, those neighborhoods, the French Quarter and the riverfront that the rest of America knows survived intact and became the engine that that we could get restarted to keep us alive. But in the neighborhoods where the music is made and where the musicians live and where the culture of New Orleans is born, those neighborhoods went under 4, 6, 8 feet of water. And they're being hauled back now by tenacity and brute force and the kindness of strangers. They're mostly back now, not entirely back. If you come to New Orleans, enjoy it. Ask someone who lives here to take you out for a ride so you can see what else is going on in the neighborhoods, and sign up someplace and come help for a while, because there's still work to do.
Bruce Nolan is a reporter for the Times-Picayune. Bruce, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Bill Quigley is co-author of the New Orleans Pain Index. He's a law professor at Loyola University and currently legal director at the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York. Bill, thanks to you as well.
Thank you very much.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, the long-term effects of this recession on young workers. One scholar says it may affect lower incomes for more than a decade. And Friday, we speak with Mary Tillman. Her son, Pat, gave up his pro football career to join the Army. He was killed in Afghanistan, and first the Army told Mary that Pat died leading an attack against the enemy. She later learned that he was shot by friendly fire. The Tillmans maintain that the Army tried to cover up the truth. That's Friday, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Hinckley, Allen & Snyder, where partners have been giving clients practical legal advice for over 100 years throughout New England and now including Connecticut, online at haslaw.com. And the Institute of Contemporary Art on the Boston waterfront. Discover the power and beauty of new art and ideas, icaboston.org.
I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The 33 miners trapped deep underground for 20 days now in Chile appear to be in good spirits, sharing food, asking for wine, and remarkably maintaining a leadership structure that appears to have helped them survive. But rescuers communicating with the men through two small holes drilled into the earth have not told the miners yet that it could take as long as 4 months to get them out. The BBC's Gideon Long is at Camp Hope, a makeshift settlement where the rescue operations are centered. And Gideon, some of these men are veteran miners. Do they realize that it could take as long as 4 months to get them out?
Well, the government says that it hasn't told them explicitly that it could take up to 4 months to bring them out. But they also say that the miners probably know that, or they probably have some sense that they're in there for a long time. They say that because these men know the mine inside out. They know there are no easy escape routes. They know that it's going to take a long time to drill down to them.
Now, we know that this mine is sort of described as almost corkscrew-shaped, going down, you know, some 2,000 feet down to this area where the men are. Can you describe what you know that area where they are is to be like?
Yes, the refuge where they've been sheltering is right down at the bottom of the mine. It's specifically designed as a rescue shelter. They had some food and water in the shelter, but in terms of the conditions, we've seen some pictures of the interior of the mine, these narrow tunnels. It looks fairly cramped. Having said that, the good news is that the miners' shelter is in a safe part of the mine. There's not much of a danger of a rock collapse there. So that means that the miners can actually leave the shelter, and they should be able to walk and exercise in the tunnels surrounding the shelter without the danger of a rock fall.
How old are the miners?
The oldest of the miners is 63. The youngest of the miners is only 19 years old, so a huge age range there. And it does seem as though the 63-year-old and some of the older miners have acted as leaders, as you were saying. There's this command structure, if you like, which is taking hold in the mine, and they're being very disciplined about the way they ration food.
Gideon, it's my understanding that family members have sent messages to the trapped miners, and psychologists are there at the site helping the family members craft these messages. Why psychologists?
Well, I think from now on, the psychological aspect of this ordeal is going to become all the more important. Initially, obviously, the concern was whether the miners were in good health physically. It seems that they are. They've had very few complaints, and, of course, now they can get food and water to them. But psychologically, being underground for 4 months is going to be incredibly difficult for them. So there are psychologists here who have been already sending down questionnaires to the miners to ask them about their state of mental health. And the government said yesterday that it was taking some little measures, like, for example, dropping playing cards and games down to the miners so they can keep themselves occupied. And also, they've been instructing the miners on how they can exercise by walking in the tunnels surrounding the shelter.
Mm-hmm. It's my understanding that the Chilean officials have contacted NASA officials in the U.S. to try to help get some advice about how people can stay in confined spaces for such a long period of time.
That's right. This is an interesting move. The Chilean government has been talking to NASA. They're due to be in a confined space up to 4 months, much like being in space in some ways.
Now, what about mine safety in Chile because of this collapse? So the New York Times is reporting today that at one point this mine was closed in 2007 because a miner died, but then it reopened in 2008 for unexplained reasons. Are people pushing that point right now?
Absolutely, they are, and there's going to be a huge investigation into what has happened at this mine. There are hundreds, thousands of these smaller and medium-sized mines dotted around the country, and there maybe safety regulations are not so good and will be looked at very closely in the light of this drama.
It is a drama. It's an amazing story. You know, I expect that we will see a movie version of it in the not-too-distant future, and the mood there must just be incredible.
It is incredible. Here at the head of the mine, we're just a few hundred meters from where they're hoping to start the drilling very soon. They've planted 33 flags in the desert, 32 of them Chilean and one Bolivian. There's one Bolivian miner down in the mine. And all around, there are these little grottos that have been setting up with personal mementos of the miners, things like photographs of them, messages of support. So it's quite emotive. I think people are still living off the euphoria they felt when they heard on Sunday for the first time that the miners were alive.
All right. Well, BBC correspondent Gideon Long, who is covering the mine rescue from Chile. Thanks very much for being with us, Gideon.
Thank you.
It's here and now. It's estimated that two-thirds of Americans are overweight or obese, and childhood obesity has tripled in the last 30 years. David Kessler is working to change that. When he was the commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration, Kessler took on big tobacco. Now he is on a campaign to change the way we eat. Kessler says foods high in fat, sugar, and salt can change the brain's chemistry and condition us to overeat. He also says the food industry knows this, and it's layering its products with those ingredients so we keep eating. Last year, David Kessler wrote about his research in the book The End of Overeating, which will be released in paperback next month. We spoke with him when the book was first published, and we asked him to explain the science behind why we're driven to overeat when we're faced with some of our favorite foods.
Take a vanilla milkshake. What's in the vanilla milkshake? Sugar, fat, flavor. What's the key driver? We published a paper. It's called Deconstructing the Vanilla Milkshake. In fact, it's sugar that is the key driver. But when you add fat, you make the food even more reinforcing. Animals and humans will work for reinforcing substances. Then we did work with our colleagues abroad in Italy, and we found that food that is multisensory, fat and sugar, elevates and keeps elevated the dopamine response. What dopamine does is it focuses your attention. It tells you, in essence, that's important, focus on it. Pick a favorite food.
Cookies.
What kind?
Chocolate chip.
Chocolate chip cookies. Mm. And they're right here. They're warm and they're mounds of chocolate. Are you talking to me, or are you listening? Paying attention to those chocolate chip cookies?
I'm paying attention to those cookies.
Right. Then you understand dopamine. You understand what attentional focus is. So if you make something multisensory, and you have past learning, right, that there was pleasure from it, you put those cookies in front of us. You don't have to even taste it. It will grab your attention. There'll be arousal. And how do you release that? You eat it. And every time you eat it, you start the cycle again of consumption. Cue, attention, arousal, release. And every time you engage in that behavior, you strengthen the neural circuits.
You're not talking about an eating disorder.
Not at all. We ask people, your favorite fruit in front of you, do you perceive a loss of control? Do you have a lack of feeling full? Do you have a preoccupation? Do you think about foods in between meals? Certain people look at me and say, what are you talking about? They can't relate. Others, when I raise it, say, you're describing me. Hmm. And we found that about 50% of obese individuals, about 30% of overweight individuals, about 20% of healthy weight individuals self-report having those three characteristics and scoring very high on those behaviors. And we call that constellation of characteristics conditioned hypereating. It's conditioned and driven behavior. Not only do you repeat it, but there's a driven component. You want it. With my colleagues at Yale, with Dana Small, one of the great neuroimagers, we took people who have conditioned hypereating and we put them in the scanner. Now, the power of food comes from our ability to anticipate it. Not necessarily just eating it and putting it in our mouth, but if those cookies are there, that anticipation, that cue, activates the amygdala of the brain. What we saw in people who have conditioned hypereating, that amygdala, those neural circuits, become amplified when you are cued during that anticipatory phase. But what was even more fascinating was once consumption began, in people who don't have conditioned hypereating, that neural activation stops. But people who have a hard time controlling their eating, that activation continues until the food is gone. So there's a hyperactivation of the neural circuits. But understand, I'm not describing a disease. We're wired to focus on the most salient stimuli in our environment. For many of us, it's food.
And Dr. Kessler, you say what we need is food rehab. What exactly does that involve?
Now, let's just deal with one thing. Diets don't work.
And why not? Deprivation, you actually have a scientific reason for that, right? Deprivation does what?
It increases the reward value of the food. But more importantly, if your old circuits respond to all the cues in your environment, to those cookies, to your other favorite fruits, and I take those foods away for 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, sure, you're going to lose weight. I put you back in your environment. You still have that old neural circuitry there, that old learning. Of course, with that old neural circuitry there, you're going to continue to engage in your old behavior. The only way you can deal with that behavior, once that old neural circuitry is laid down, is to add on to that new learning.
Now, we will always want French fries.
Let's talk about that. Under certain conditions, the answer is probably true. If I stress you, if you're fatigued, if you're deprived. But let's say those French fries are in front of you. What are the options? How do we cool the stimulus? First, you can simply say, take those French fries away. Get rid of the cue. But how realistic is it in our current environment? Another technique is that I can avoid being primed, P-R-I-M-E-D. Once you put that first French fry in your mouth, it enhances the stimulation, the neural activation, and you stay active, that brain circuitry stays activated until all the fries are gone, so you avoid being primed. A third way is to learn to eat in a planned way. So you set certain rules for yourself. I'm not going to eat between meals. And you condition yourself to do that, and that's what you want to do. Then when you're cued in between meals, if you know you're not going to eat, it's an impossibility, then the stimulus doesn't have the same ability to activate the neural circuits. But in the end, the most effective way to decrease the amount of stimulation is to change your relationship with the food, what psychologists call a critical perceptual shift. If you look at those fries and say, that's my friend, boy, is that going to taste great? That's going to only activate your reward circuits of your brain. If, on the other hand, you can get to the point where you look at those fries and say, that's not my friend, that's just fat and salt, then you cool off the stimulus.
That's former FDA Commissioner David Kessler. His book, The End of Overeating, Taking Control of the Insatiable American Appetite, is coming out in paperback. Back in a minute, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
The question, what time is it, is a simple one to answer now in 2010, but not all that long ago, it was not. Howard Mansfield's new book examines our relationship with time, reminding us that we haven't always operated on the same clock. Local time used to be sun time, so when it was noon in Chicago, it was 11:50 a.m. in St. Louis and 12:18 in Detroit. There were literally hundreds of local times, and then it all changed. Howard Mansfield's book is Turn and Jump, How Time and Place Fell Apart. And he joins us from the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio. Howard, what happened when time was standardized?
Tremendous dislocation, protest even. In Cincinnati, the newspaper said, well, why should we put ourselves away from the truth of the sun and moon and the stars by half an hour just for some imaginary line drawn in Pittsburgh? And in Augusta, Maine, they took a referendum and 3/4 of the population refused to go on standard time. What you have to know about it is that the railroads decided where the time zones are, not the federal government, not the United States. And they did this in 1883. After they did that, time and place, which used to be one thing, in other words, noon was when the sun was directly overhead where you were, time was when you planted or when you harvested in your field or when you did your particular chores. Then they became two things. Time was standardized. Everybody had the same noon in your time zone. That goes on all throughout the 19th century. You go to work in the factory, each hour has to be like the next hour. Each task has to be like the next task, which is very different than working out in the farm or out in the field from season to season. So to everything there is a season. That's the old world. The new world, the world we know, is a word that sort of comes up in the end of the 19th century, the continuous. I talk about continuous vaudeville in the book. Mm. You could say this is part of the origins of what we call 24/7 time.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that this was a positive thing or not?
I guess you can't sort it out that neatly, positive or negative. It makes prosperity possible because you can produce more things. Everybody can be on the same clock in a sense, but you also lose a lot of the special qualities of place, and you also begin to crowd people out. They feel anxious. And if you go back to the 1890s, there's all this talk of American nervousness and as it's being a special thing and anxiety, much like you hear today, people being very concerned about this tremendous flood of digital information coming at them. And in the book, I talk about this play, The Old Homestead, which was the most popular play on Broadway in 1887. It was huge. I mean, 300,000 New Yorkers went to see this in the space of a couple of months. It was the cats of its day. I mean, people went to see it 3, 4, 5 times. And what this play is this fellow, Denman Thompson, who grew up in New Hampshire, playing this character, Uncle Josh, who was a kindly uncle everybody wished they had back on the farm. And this takes place in a barnyard, and it's all these people just doing chores all the time, and they're live oxen. And people loved it. Who was going to see this? People who had grown up on the farm and now were working in the city and just missed it. And they would write letters to Uncle Josh saying, you know, the live oxen are great, but could you put crows in there? And could we see a cat? Or could you have a cow? What they were looking at was, in a sense, an old clock. We used to keep time this way by the chore. The time used to go this slowly. We used to be barefoot. That's gone.
And you also mentioned continuous vaudeville. How does that exactly fit into your examination of time?
Actually, the very same year that the railroad standardized time, 1883, this fellow, Benjamin Franklin Keith, who we know as the K in RKO, was a vaudevillian, and he had a theater in Boston. He said, you know, I'm spending all this time getting people in and out of the theater all day. You know, when people come in the theater and it's full, they sit right down. When they come in the theater and it's empty, they hesitate. I'm going to run the show continuously. It won't stop. For your dime, you could sit there 12, 14 hours a day, however long it is. But, of course, he did want you to leave eventually. So what he did was, one act would be a chaser, good enough to see once, but not twice. So there were entire class of acts that spent their lives watching people leave the theater. But the genius of the continuous is it reflects industrial production. It reflects what was going on in America, everything. The seasons were kind of going away, and everything was going to be 24/7 and available everywhere. And that starts happening with the railroads. Keith caught that completely in that invention. And vaudeville became hugely popular, and people talked about continuous.
You also described Derby's Department Store in Peterborough, New Hampshire, as a sort of an American clock. What does Derby say to you about time?
Derby's was, you know, a family store like every town used to have. It starts out in the 19th century as a general store, it becomes a five and dime, then it becomes a department store in the 1940s and 50s. And what you see in Derby's is the entire American century moving through this place. Clarence Derby, whose family owned the store, and he starts out in the basement in this dirty cellar, really, pumping molasses into jugs and pumping vinegar into jugs and unloading dynamite. You could buy dynamite sticks in New Hampshire at the time. And then he goes on to manage the store, and he sells the first TV in town, and then the first color TV in town, and then the first shopping center is built at the edge of town. Does he move or does he stay? And then into the 60s, he kept a diary. All of a sudden, he's writing, kids are shoplifting. Now, that never happened. So you see all the American prosperity, the whole thing in this one store. And the other thing you see is in a completely different kind of timekeeping. He had clerks, a big staff of clerks. When you went to shop there, you went to see the clerk, and the clerk helped you. These clerks worked there 20, 25, 30, 40 years. And these clerks, the equivalent of the people now who are stacking shelves in Walmart, these clerks living in Peterborough, New Hampshire, could buy a house in Peterborough, a very good town, put braces on their kids, and send their kids to college, all by being a clerk. And it was all, when you went to see them, you wanted to see that. You wanted to see Marion Griswold. You wanted to see the clerk in that department. It was a visit and a shopping thing. It had more dimension than our so-called more efficient shopping today.
Turn and Jump, the title of your book. What does it mean?
Vaudevillians would talk about taking a turn on stage and then a jump. How would they get to the next city? They had to get on the train. And if they had to, an overnight, it was like or change of train. It was a broken night jump. And to me, that just got at the way a lot of people are living today. You know, they do their turn. They jump on to the next thing. It seemed to reflect the American effort to just constantly use every moment of time you can.
One of the amazing stories that you tell in the book was the one about the strikes and the riots in 1886. You called those time wars.
Some labor historians call those time wars because obviously we think of strikes about wages and benefits. But my God, imagine this. You start out in life and you're on the farm someplace. You do your chores. It's hard work, but you're your own boss. You pretty much decide what you're going to do, or the seasons dictate it. You get in the factory, right? Each hour, each minute has to be exactly like the next minute. If you're on the assembly line, the thing's coming down, you've got to do your same little motion over and over and over. And it's dangerous, too. And you don't have any say in how to design your work and how to control your time. And there's all these times where if you're back in agricultural time when you would take off to go fishing or to visit with a neighbor, you can't do that. So a lot of these strikes are about trying to get control of your time again.
You know, the last sentence in your book is, throw out your clocks. Really? Should we really throw out our clocks?
Metaphorically, everybody's too bound up. Everybody's trying to multitask and talk on phones and drive. And no one's, the more you do that, you know, the less you start living. Yeah. Interrogate your inventions and your devices. Is this making me happier? Is this making the task at hand more efficient so it frees me so I can really live and do things that are of value? Yeah. Interrogate your clocks, throw out your clocks, unplug some of them. Why not? I'm chronically on time myself. I don't have a watch, but I'm chronically on time always.
You don't have a watch?
Time is everywhere, and you can always ask someone.
Well, Howard Mansfield, your new book is Turn and Jump, How Time and Place Fell Apart. Thanks very much for your time today.
Well, thank you, Deb. I really enjoyed it.
We are the Village Green Preservation Society. God save the little duck, Bonneville and variety. We are the Desperate Dan Appreciation Society. God save strawberry jam and all the different varieties.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Deborah Becker. Please join us again, Here and Now.
What more can we do? We are the Draft Beer Preservation Society. God save Mrs. Moss and good old Mother Riley. We are the Custard Pie Appreciation Consortium. God save the George Cross and all those who were loving them. Sherlock Holmes, English-speaking vernacular. Help save Fu Manchu, Moriarty and Dracula. We are the office block, persecution affinity. God save the little shops, China cups and virginity. We are the sky.